From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with playwright Albert Inarritu. His plays like The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpy, Gemini, and Coming of Age in Soho deal with issues of sexual identity and alienation. Also today, I speak with performance artist Meredith Monk. She composes and performs songs without words, using all the sounds the human voice is capable of, including moans, cries, and warbles. Brazilian composer and guitarist Orlando Haddad performs a couple of songs, and critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is playwright Albert Inarritu. His three best-known plays have just been collected in a new book. His Obie Award-winning play, The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpy, is about an obese adolescent consumed by self-hatred who decides to eat himself to death. Inarritu's Broadway hit, Gemini, is about a plump, somewhat clumsy Harvard student who's back home for the summer in his Italian working-class South Philadelphia neighborhood. His insecurities are set off when he's paid a visit by a beautiful WASP classmate and her trim, handsome brother. His crisis is further complicated when their visit causes him to realize he's unsure of whether he's straight or gay. Inarritu's most recent play, Coming of Age in Soho, was produced by Joseph Papp. It's about a playwright who thinks he's lost his talent. He's gay and is separating from his wife. At the same time, he meets his son, a son he never knew he fathered, in a short-lived relationship about 16 years before. Inarritu has also written for television, including the PBS Verna USO Girl, which starred Sissy Spacek. Aspects of Albert Inarritu's life appear in his plays. He grew up in an Italian neighborhood in South Philadelphia, where he attended Catholic school. He later studied at Yale Drama School, where he collaborated on a play with Christopher Durang that starred another classmate, Meryl Streep. Albert Inarritu's new collection of plays is called The Best Plays of Albert Inarritu, and it's just been published by the Gay Presses of New York. Welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to read you a quote that you had said in an interview back in 1978, and we'll see if it's still true or not. You said, "All my plays deal with outcasts who try to succeed in a society that ostracizes them very readily and very easily. I think we live in a society almost totally geared to the cosmetic." Still stand by that?
Oh, I think it's truer today than it was even then.
How so?
Well, I think that one thing that I've noticed is that in the 60s and 70s, there were people who hated women and hated gay people and hated black people and hated the notion of individuality and hated the notion of free choice. But they thought twice about expressing that hatred. And I think during the Reagan administration, the past 8 years, we've seen it become respectable for these vicious bigots to attack people. I've heard on national television people who've died of AIDS called perverts, when the people I know who've died of AIDS, and I unfortunately know too many, have been decent taxpaying citizens like anybody. I've heard all kinds of viciousness spewed out about unconforming people, whether they're women who dare to feel that they should have some control over their bodies, or whether they're men or women who have an unconventional sexual choice. And it's become more respectable. And I think in the 70s, it was a little less respectable to be that hate-filled and that bigoted. So I think it's become more so.
You said that your plays are usually about outcasts, uh-huh, or people who see themselves as outcasts. Have you always felt like an outcast yourself?
Yeah, I think so.
By virtue of?
Well, I'm a fat person in a thin society. I'm a gay person, or a mostly gay person, in a society where that's now a terrible thing to be. I think there was a time when it was a little more acceptable, but I think now it's become a cross to bear again. Many of the people I know are frightened of the potential for violence and repression, and people using AIDS as an excuse to oppress and blame people as opposed to seeing it as a terrible human tragedy that could afflict anybody. So that is, I think, as a playwright in a dying theater, one is automatically an outcast. As someone who loves literature and opera and classical music, at a time when those things seem to be dead. I teach this semester at Princeton. I teach in the graduate school at Columbia. So I get to see just how uninformed and unformed our youngsters are, including our brightest youngsters. I mean, their frame of reference doesn't include anything except television and movies.
You know, I think you really put yourself on the line in your plays. Everybody assumes that novels and plays are autobiographical, mm-hmm. whether they are or not. It's just always an assumption that's made. Your first play was, well, your first very well-known play was about someone who's very fat. Mm-hmm. Your plays have been about people who were gay before you necessarily came out. And your latest play is about a playwright who fears he's lost his talent. So readers would think, like, okay, well, we know that the playwright is someone who's overweight, gay, and who fears he's lost his talent. did you ever think of – did you ever worry about people just – being able to make presumptions about your life, whether you wanted your life to be public or not.
The irony always is, and I tell my students who write plays and then get very frightened and very inhibited, and I find this is true of women especially. Mm-hmm. I think some women are terribly self-censoring. I never realized that until I encountered them.
That's an interesting thing to say.
Yes, I think there's, so women are socialized to be very self-denying, and even the brightest young women I know in the playwriting classes are always self-censoring. Whereas the least talented male will always promote himself, and these quite talented and quite interesting women will always apologize for what they've come up with. It's very interesting, even if they have a feminist line. In fact, they're terribly self-lacerating. But I have written a play called Gus and Al, and it will be done at Playwrights Horizons this year. That's this theater run in New York, which has done a great many plays by me. It started Gemini, did my production of Ben O'Blimpy, which I directed, did a play called Herself is Lust, Earthworms. Gus and Al is about Albert Inarrado, a fat, failed playwright who travels back in time and meets up with Gustav Mahler. And it was done in a workshop in Denver last year. And one of the things that was said to me was, well, you know, some people liked it and some people who didn't like it didn't like it. But everyone, liked it, whether they liked it or not, said, isn't it terrible that you put yourself in this play? Because I'm Al, obviously. And I said, well, when I wrote Coming of Age in Soho, which is a very, very fictionalized piece, there are autobiographical elements, but I defy anyone who doesn't know my life in great detail to pick them out. Mostly, it's fiction. Nonetheless, the Variety Review, which, although it's written by a moron who doesn't even sign his entire name, is taken seriously by all our artistic theaters, said Albert Inarrado is a simple-minded, idiotic, narcissistic, appalling homosexual whose only talent is in getting his plays on. And I said to these people in Denver, and I say to everyone who asks me about that play, if someone, some fool who signs his name H-U-M-M, I don't know what that connotes, can publish that and be read and believed by people who will never read the play themselves and will never see the play themselves, then why not? What worse can be said? They're going to say it anyway. And if I felt it was important to write about my life, then I'm going to, because those hate-filled morons will say what they're going to say. You know, if I wrote as a woman, I'm sure, and thought up in a completely false name and fooled everyone, you'd still read, well, this is her life, and how dare she inflict it on us. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's...
Right. My guest is playwright Albert Inarrado, and three of his plays have just been compiled in a new anthology, which is called The Best Plays of Albert Inarrado. It seems to me that your interest in theater started when you were a child and you loved opera.
Yes, I was born with this deranged chromosome. I think I'm missing a chromosome or I have an extra one. I don't know. But I was naturally drawn to opera and the theater.
You know, I remember in my neighborhood, the kids who love classical music were made fun of, but opera was considered, like, beyond the pall.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's still considered beyond the pall, even by all kinds of people. They can be quite civilized and genteel. They still think you've got to be basically very sick.
Did you take a lot of grief for that when you were young?
Well, I don't know. I mean, probably no more for that and for lots of other things. I mean, I was kind of your classical chubby sissy, so, I mean, you always get targeted. You know, if I had loved football and, you know... And young girls in skirts, I still would have been, to some degree, picked on and made fun of. So, I think I took a certain amount of grief for it.
You went to Catholic school.
Well, I went to Catholic grade school. Then for those people in Philadelphia,
then
I went to Central.
Right, which is the school for smart kids.
In those days, anyway, I don't know what's happened to it since. But, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, that was a big escape for me. It was a lucky thing.
Do you feel that you were shaped at all by the Catholic school experience?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a revisionism that... in the Catholic Church, and it's very funny. I mean, and I know, you know, quite decent people who don't believe my stories about nuns. But unfortunately, the first women I met were these vicious nuns. They hated little. They were Irish nuns, and they hated little Italian boys. And they were really terribly, terribly aggressive and punitive and very unpleasant, and they were monstrous. Now, I know there are many brave and wonderful nuns in the world who are not like this, but unfortunately, my view of Catholicism was pre-Vatican II Catholicism, whereas if you dared to eat meat on Friday, you went to hell for eternity, for example. If you didn't fast a full 12 hours before taking the host, God was going to come and get you that night. And there was this gigantic nun in the sky who was going to swoop down and catch you if you touched yourself. You know, if you looked at the wrong TV program, if you dared to read a novel that was on that list. So that was my, yeah, so I do think it shaped me. I'm still sort of fighting to get out of that notion of that nun up there that's going to swoop down and punish me.
Your character in Gemini is very self-conscious about his working-class background and coming from this row house-type neighborhood. Yeah. And he's also very self-conscious about being kind of clumsy and kind of chubby with all these, like, really trim, good-looking, more wealthy people around. Did you have that experience when you went to Yale?
Well, I wouldn't say it was all that simple. I mean, it was never quite – I mean, I had that experience probably more vigorously at Central because I really had never met anybody who wasn't Italian or Jewish. Our neighborhood was Italian and Jewish, and you sort of needed a scorecard to tell the difference. And up at Central, finally, I met upper-middle-class people. Well, we were not by any means deprived or starving in the street. But I think that it was very definitely, though, a working class, a lower middle class milieu. No one's parents had been to college. No one really read or thought of themselves as educated. And suddenly to go to Central and meet, you know, I never had met a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, before I went to Central. I had never met upper middle class or wealthy people. I'd never met people whose parents were terribly interested in intellectual things or who were distinguished. So it was really, and to be a high school kid without the resources, you know, with that kind of clumsy thing that happens in high school, was very disconcerting. And I think the germ of the play was probably more high school than college, because by college I had sort of, you know, developed my own way of dealing with it. But it took me a while to...
When you were in college, you were in one of those Yale Drama School classes that...
Drama School, yes.
Yeah, that gave birth to all these great...
No, it was an amazing class. It really was an amazing class.
It was Christopher Durang, the playwright.
Yes, Wendy Wasserstein, another quite distinguished playwright. Sigourney Weaver, famous actress. Meryl Streep. James Lapine, who is doing In the Woods now with Stephen Sondheim and just did Sundays in the Park with George 2 years ago. Was around. It was an extraordinary class. It was really extraordinary.
Did you realize it at the time?
Yes, yes. I think we were all very impressed with ourselves.
Were you vicious and jealous?
No, because I tell you, the drama school was. I have to say that what happened there was that it was so punitive that we all were very. We tended to cling to one another for sanity and endurance. They threw out half my class the first year, and they did it publicly. So they had accepted all these people, and then they just threw everybody out. They kept 9 out of 18, and they announced who they were throwing out in front of someone. Someone got up. I don't want to name who it was. Got up and said, "I'm going to call a group of names, and please leave if I call your name because you are no longer one of us." And they called these names, and you watched people go out. It was horrible. It was a horrifying thing. And they were always evaluating people in public and doing things like saying, you know, you're hopeless, you're preposterous, you're always late, you dress badly. It was amazing. It was a very cruel. So when I read these books, there's a new book about Juilliard out. And when I read these books, the book is written as though it's shocking that a piano teacher might throw the music out the window or throw a tantrum. Well, it isn't. That's nothing.
Well, that seems to me to be a very minor part of the difficulty and actually of the suffering that you went through to achieve a life in the arts. And I'm thinking about when you first came to New York and you were broke.
Oh, I've had many a nightmare in my life.
And you were sick part of that time,
I got very sick, yes. I had had this operation at Yale, which was I had a chronic condition that was minor but unfortunate to have. But they had invented this operation, and I was one of the first people it was done on in this country. It was actually invented in England. And I was a student at Yale, and it was done for free, and I got all this care. But it was an experimental operation. And I came to New York, and I had some odd jobs, and I got a Guggenheim grant. And about a week after the Guggenheim grant ran out, I got a job as a messenger because I really had to keep myself afloat. And this operation literally unraveled, and I began to hemorrhage, which was one of the side effects that they really didn't know what happened until it happened. And I didn't have health insurance. I had a minor health insurance plan, but they would not cover pre-existing conditions, which is a typical problem with insurance companies, and this was a pre-existing condition, and the period of time which needs to elapse hadn't elapsed. And I was reduced to begging people. I was very sick. I had a high fever. I was in agony, and I had a lot of pain, and I was scared. And I went through as a what firsthand people go through when you suddenly have nothing. When I see bag people in this country, I'm just I know exactly what that feels like, to sit in a Medicaid office bleeding and to be told, well, we can't help you. You're white, or who would ever believe you can't, your family won't help you. And they were poor people. My family were not well-to-do and suffered through it, but I mean, there was not much they could do. And I don't always tell the whole story, but the doctor at Yale, you know, said, you've got to come back. You're very sick. We have to do something. You know, you're bleeding. You have this high fever and you're infected and all of this stuff. I mean, you have an infection that was going through your system. I went to the hospital in New Haven. They said, where's your insurance? I said, well, I won't cover this, unfortunately. They said, well, we need $3,000 in cash today or we won't admit you. And I was bleeding. So I went back to New York. I couldn't raise that sum of money. I was reduced to begging people. And you find out, as I tell people sometimes, young people, when I meet them, no one's going to help you. It's one of the first lessons in life.
But isn't this the kind of time when you ask yourself, maybe I should have gone into the insurance business instead of playwriting? Does that bring out your insecurities about making a living in the world of the arts?
Oh, yes, everything does. But I'll finish the story. I came back to New York and I had to sit in a Medicaid office, and they said, well, the only way we could possibly give you money would be in a week. You know, I needed this operation like yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, it has to be done by someone in New York City, in Manhattan. And I said, well, it's a special operation. It was done in New Haven. They said, well, you've got to go to New Haven Welfare and see if they'll help you. Well, I wasn't a resident of New Haven, so I couldn't help there. So the doctor said, come and you spend the night in my garage, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, you go out and lie in the street, and I'll call an ambulance.
Oh, no.
And they'll rush you to the hospital, and they cannot refuse you by federal law. They can't refuse to admit someone who's brought in an ambulance, whether they have insurance or not. And that's how we'll get you in, and that's what we did.
That's remarkable.
That's really what happened. That's how I got in the hospital that time. So, you know, I learned. So, yes, I know, but it has never occurred to me not to be what I am, unfortunately. I mean, and as well, since I'm teaching now, I do tell students, you know, if you really can do something else and be happy, I advise you to do it. It's a very tough profession, and I don't know that there's anybody who is an exception, really. Any writers now, you know, great actors. Actors can make substantial sums of money if they become movie or television stars. A playwright like Sam Shepard, who's become a movie star, is making much more in movies than he ever made from his plays, though he's one of our more successful playwrights. But most playwrights and writers, period, do poorly, even ones you've heard of and think do well.
My guest is playwright Albert Inarritu, and his plays include The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpie, Gemini, and Coming of Age in Soho. And we're going to talk some more about theater after we take this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Playwright Albert Inarritu is my guest, and three of his plays have just been issued in a new book called The Best Plays of Albert Inarritu. I think one of the difficult things for any playwright who's getting started is getting their plays staged. And in those early days when you're getting your plays staged, it's not necessarily going to be the most professional production. Did you ever have troubles with that when you were starting?
Well, not when I was starting. You see, I think as I mentioned in the introduction in this book, we had a theater in those days between 1975 and 1979. It was a theater of poverty. But you did have a community of theater people, actors and directors who were theater people, who wanted to do new plays and were staying in Manhattan to do new plays. And in those days, you could live in Manhattan on relatively little. Rents were not sky high. And we all hoped that Broadway would revive any day and rescue us. So actually, the first productions I got in Manhattan, though everyone worked for free, this is off Broadway, tended to be pretty good. I had Meryl Streep in my play. Sigourney Weaver was in the very first performance of Gemini. You know, actors who are very respectable now, I don't know if their names will be known, Ann DeSalvo, John Polito. People you see on television, all the Reed Birney, whether you recognize them or not, Danny Aiello, were all in my plays. But that's because I mentioned in the book that Gemini was first read in the living room of Mike Tucker and Jill Eikenberry of L.A. Law. And Bruce Weitz, who went on to Hill Street Blues, was read The Father. And Danny DeVito, who was in Taxi, was there with some girlfriend. And it was an extraordinary feeling of community and of these people. Now, I would say 90% of them have fled. They've really gone to L.A. And they are working in television or in movies or trying to. And I think what has happened in Manhattan is that most people are not stage-oriented in Manhattan. If they want to be actors or directors in Manhattan, they're looking to break in on the East Coast into movies and TV because that's the only way there's a hunger for product in television and movies and you can work. And so I think what's happened in the past 7 or 8 years in Manhattan is that there's been a radical diminution of really good theater people, actors and directors, and that does affect staging. So I've had more trouble subsequently.
Do you work closely with the director who's
doing your plays? Well, I've directed a lot of my own work. I directed Coming of Age in Soho in two versions of the Public Theater with Joe Papp breathing down my neck. I directed a production of Ben Oblimpy at Playwrights Horizons, which did pretty well. I've directed around the country. I've directed some plays. I've directed Ben Oblimpy in London. But no more. After Coming of Age in Soho, I nearly thought I thought I would die, and so therefore I have sworn not to direct my own stuff again.
What's the problem with directing it yourself?
Well, I don't think there should be a problem with directing anything yourself, but there's an enormous bias against writers in this theater. It's a bias among reviewers. It's a bias among producers. There's a feeling that writers are incompetent for the stage. And so therefore, you have to buck the tide if you direct, and that's very difficult. And then secondly, it's because we write plays only for reviewers, you realize there is no audience for the average new play in America. And your only hope is to get sufficiently good reviews that you can either get a grant or a TV job. It's the only way you can possibly live, or that some European producer gets interested having read the review and decides to do the play there. Or you get a movie sale because some movie person reads the review and thinks it looks interesting. That's why the Variety review is important. Therefore, we're only writing plays for reviewers. And that being the case, there's no point in investing yourself because I don't know any reviewers who come with an open mind. They write their reviews on the subway or in the cab to the theater. They're not all fools or dishonest. Some of them are bright and some of them are fair. But I don't know that directing your own play does anything for you because they've already decided when they get there, pretty much.
You obviously are not pleased with the work of the New York critics. Let me ask you something about Coming of Age in Soho. That was your first play in, I think, 4 years?
Yeah.
Is it dangerous to be out of circulation for 4 years?
Well, yes, and it was very hard to get it produced, actually. No one wanted to do it. I've never had a mainstream success, though Gemini is one of the longer-running plays since the 60s in America. And was successful around the country, actually. It was done a lot around the country. But I'm not a popular playwright. Gemini was not a much admired play in the profession, and I'm not widely liked in the profession, and that has a lot to do with it. Maybe the plays are lousy. There's always that possibility. I prefer to think they aren't. But no, it was difficult to get the plays on. It's been difficult to get these two new plays on. I'll have two new on this year, but it's been hard.
Were you writing during that four-year period?
Yeah, I wrote a novel called Yankee Diva. I wrote various drafts of plays. It was very difficult. I had a very hard time in my 30s. Norman Mailer cursed me in my 30s. In those days, I wanted to have an income when I was just – Gemini happened when I had just turned 30. So in my other 30s, I wanted to have an income, and I did a lot of TV and movie things. And I was out in California once, and I had breakfast with Norman Mailer at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And it was with Norman Mailer and Jules Pfeiffer. And I'm not a morning person, as those who heard me speak this morning at the music festival here know by this point, unfortunately. But I was in a very bad mood this particular morning, and the waiters kept ignoring me. They were bringing Jules and Norman their breakfast, and I'm sitting there. You know, I'm a large person, so I needed my coffee and carbohydrate quick, and they weren't bringing it. And finally, I banged on the table and said, "Can I get service here?" And Norman looked at me, and he said, "You know, you will be miserable in your 30s because I was." So he cursed me. Whenever I see him, I say, "You cursed me, Norman," because my 30s were very difficult. And I had a hard time adjusting both to the success of Gemini and to the failure of Gemini because I don't believe that any of the lies circulated about Gemini were true. I think they're lies. I heard that play described as a sellout. I heard it described as a cartoon. And it's not. It wasn't. There was a commercial that ran in the New York area that was 30 seconds long, and it emphasized some of the big laughs in the show. But the show was a lot. If you read it, and of course most reviewers can't read, we understand that. But if you actually read the play, you find that that isn't the case. So I had a schizophrenic experience, and it was hard to adjust to that.
In Coming of Age in Soho, the playwright character, the main uh-huh. character, says he's 36 and he's thinking, like, maybe I've lost my talent.
Uh-huh.
And he's saying, I wasn't a success. I wasn't significant. I was a trend.
Yes.
Is that something you were feeling?
Oh,
at
yes.
Some point
I think
yourself?
It's something every. I said this morning and raised a lot of hackles, but I think it's true. It was right about Philip Glass this morning. I mean, I admire and respect Philip Glass, but when someone used him as an example of a serious artist who can attract an audience, I said, is that a serious artist spontaneously attracting his audience through his magic of his music, or is he a trend who has luckily gotten the lottery number this year and is being promoted? And unfortunately, I think in all of our serious arts, that's often how it works. You become a brand name for a time, and then they turn on you.
You know what I wanted to ask you? We opened the interview by talking about a quote that you said in 1978 about how we live in a society almost totally geared to the cosmetic. And I know I've seen a poster or a blown-up photo of you from, I guess, the late 70s or something, where you were much thinner.
Yes, no, my weight has gone up and down in my life, yes.
Yeah, are there times when you get more concerned with fitting the cosmetics of the society, and other times when you feel like the heck with it?
Well, yes, but I also think that those thin photos were, I had just been sick. I had been sick for a while, so I had lost a lot of weight that way. But yeah, I think all people, you have to sort out, you know, what you are and who you are. And wanting to fit in with other people's approval is an important thing, to be thin, to act straight, to write a certain kind of play, to have a certain kind of manner, not to have opinions that are unpopular. Those are important. And, you know, making a career in the arts is as political as anything else. The people who make careers are often very good at making contacts and making the most of their personas, whatever their talents are. And some are very talented, but they do have a knack for politicizing themselves in a good way, and I don't. Unfortunately, I have almost never in my life been able to pretend to anything I didn't actually feel, but I've suffered a lot for that. I've made a lot of enemies. So.
You grew up really loving opera, and now you're writing plays without music. Didn't you try to write operas when you were
young? Well, I was a composer when I was younger, but I mean, I wasn't especially talented. I was terribly ambitious. I was not, I would say, a great talent at all. I don't even think I had much of a knack, but...
Do you get pleasure in going to plays now that you're writing them yourself, or are you too critical thinking?
I think it's hard. You know, it's whenever you're in a – I'm sure if you listen to other interview programs, you probably get antsy. You know, I wouldn't have asked that question.
Well, no. I mean, one hand's turning the dial on and the other hand's turning it off, you know?
So it can be hard if you are in that profession. And also, you're caught between sympathizing a lot with people, feeling sorry for the writer if he's gotten screwed in the casting or the directing, or admiring someone's guts. And sometimes you also do feel very critical because you try to face the same program, you face the same problems with people.
So you're working on some new plays now.
Yes, I have two that'll be done this year.
Could you tell us briefly the theme of
Well, Gus and Al is about...
That's the one you mentioned before.
I mentioned, yes, Albert Inarrado gets into a time machine in despair and travels back to Vienna 1900 and meets up with Gustav Mahler, Sigmund Freud, Alma Mahler, and several other people in Mahler's circle. And the other one is going to be done here in Philadelphia. It's called... Magda Returns with Kallas, and it's about a famous opera singer who has had a bunch of crises in her life and comes back to her family home in South Philadelphia and tries to start her life up anew.
Well, good luck with them.
Thank you very much.
And I thank you for talking
with us
about your work.
My pleasure.
My guest has been playwright Albert Inarrado, and a collection of three of his plays has just been published by the Gay Presses of New York. It's called Best Plays of Albert Inarrado, and it features The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpie, Gemini, and Coming of Age in Soho. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In our next show, I'll speak with Mark Matabani. He grew up in poverty in black South Africa. His tennis-playing abilities caught the attention of Arthur Ashe, who sponsored his move to the United States, where he now lives, teaches, and writes. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with composer, singer, and choreographer Meredith Monk. Her songs without words express the full range of human emotion. On her new album, she performs her own compositions from the past 15 years. Also today, composer and guitarist Orlando Haddad performs songs from his native Brazil. And critic Ken Tucker reviews The Night of the Hunter. Robert Mitchum plays a deranged preacher, and Shelley Winters co-stars as a gullible widow. This 1955 classic is now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. For this week's performance spot, we've invited singer and guitarist Orlando Haddad to share a couple of Brazilian songs. Orlando was born and raised in Brazil. He moved to the United States in 1974. Since then, he and his wife Patricia have led a band called Minas, named after the place in Brazil where he was born. The best known and most widely recorded Brazilian popular song is probably Antonio Carlos Jobim's hit, The Girl from Ipanema. We asked Orlando to introduce us to some songs which are not as familiar.
Here are two songs from two different Brazilian films. The first one is called A Felicidade by Antonio Carlos Jobim. A Felicidade from the movie Black Orpheus. It means happiness, and it's a song about the fragility of happiness. A felicidade é como a gota de orvalho numa pétala de flor. Brilha tranquila, depois de leve oscila e cai como uma lágrima de amor. Tristeza não tem fim. Felicidade, sim. A felicidade é como a pluma que o vento vai levando pelo ar. Voa tão leve, mas tem a vida breve. Precisa que haja vento sem parar. A felicidade do pobre parece a grande ilusão do carnaval. A gente trabalha um ano inteiro por um momento de sonho, pra fazer a fantasia de rei ou de pirata ou jardineira. E tudo se acabar na quarta-feira. Tristeza não tem fim. This next song is by Brazilian composer and poet Chico Buarque, who writes love pop songs with very political connotations. And these songs become hits on the radio down in Brazil. The song is also from a film, Ópera do Malandro, a recent Brazilian film, and describes the old-style malandro. The malandro is a character from the 40s and 50s who is a macho guy dressed slick and lived off of women. Chico says that this old-style malandro has completely been absorbed into society, has disappeared. Maybe he has a family, who knows. But that the new malandro, the one who is acting as malandro today, is not on the street, but in politics, government, and big business.
Eu quis fazer samba em homenagem à nata da malandragem que conheço de outros carnavais. Eu fui à Lapa e perdi a viagem que aquela tal malandragem não existe mais. Agora já não é normal o que dá de malandro popular profissional. Malandro com aparato de malandro oficial, malandro candidato a malandro federal, malandro com retrato na coluna social, malandro com contrato, com gravata e capital, que nunca se dá mal, mas o malandro pra valer não espalha, aposentou a navalha. Tem mulher e filho e tal e tal. Dizem as más línguas que ele até trabalha, mora lá longe, chacoalha no trem da central. Para papá.
Orlando Haddad will be back with more sambas and bossa novas on future editions of Fresh Air. His band Minos has one album titled Numja Azu. They're now working on a second record. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Meredith Monk. She's been at the forefront of the experimental performance scene for many years. She's currently preparing to perform with her vocal ensemble at the Next Wave Festival in New York. She's also working on an opera for the Houston Grand Opera. Meredith Monk is a composer, choreographer, dancer, theater director, and singer. As a composer and singer, she's invented a vocabulary of sounds which have no literal meaning, but evoke a range of emotions. On her new album, her seventh, Do You Be, she sings compositions from the last 16 years. Na 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 ah ah na 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 ah ah ma 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 ah ah na 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 ah ah na 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 ah ah na ah 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 ah
thing that's wonderful about the voice is that it deals with emotions that we don't have words for. It actually gets between the cracks of emotions that we talk about.
Were you trained to sing conventionally?
I did study at Sarah Lawrence. I studied a voice, vocal chamber music and leader and regular classical singing.
Mm-hmm. Now, why didn't you stick with that?
Well, I actually don't think, I think I really don't have the temperament to do that. I was always interested in making things, and even when I was at school, I was already starting to work on pieces of my own, and I think that, I think that my temperament is more that I'm interested in finding things, and I don't think I would have been content to be an interpreter. I do think that being an interpreter is a real life work, though. I mean, I'm saying for some people, I think that that's really certainly enough and very honorable, and there's a lot to do.
One of the earliest pieces on your new album, Do You Be, I want to talk about that for a minute. It's almost to me as if you had found a way to make crying into music.
I always actually think of that piece as flying rather than crying. It's very, because the form is quite simple, it really is a kind of a rise, it goes up to its height, and then it comes down. It always feels like it's very much in space, and it's one of my favorite songs to perform, as a matter of fact.
I think of your music as expressing musically things like sighs and moans and laughs and crying, just really emotionally deep things, but without words.
Mm-hmm. Well, all those gestures, those are really human vocal gestures, are part of a vocabulary of the voice. And another thing that I've loved working with the voice over the years is seeing that when you work with your own instrument, you come upon what I would call archetypal songs or vocal sounds that exist in a lot of different cultures. And that's one level, which is that voices have a lot in common all over the world. For example, if I came upon something like a glottal break when I'm working myself with my own voice, that exists in a lot of different cultures. It exists in African music. It exists in yodeling. It exists in North Carolina hollering. It exists in Balkan music. So that's something that's a thing that's in each person's voice, but has a kind of world manifestation. And that's one level. And then the other thing that's wonderful is that each person's voice is completely different. So people really develop their own vocabularies, and there's certain vocal cords that do certain things, and there's certain vocal cords that don't do certain things. And that's the thing that gives each person their unique vocal qualities.
Do you think that you use male and female voices differently?
Well, I think that I know more about the female voice. For example, with The Ringing Place, the piece that I'm working on now, I'm working a lot with resonance and quite high. So I'm working with a lot of dealing with head resonance, way up in the top of the head resonance. And I'm trying to find what that is in a man's voice, which is quite different. For the men, it's falsetto, but the resonance is very different. And I'm trying to find what a comparable thing for a man's voice would be. Or is it just that what I'm interested in is these upper partials and, you know, this kind of high sound. So right now that's what we're working with, because I'm working with the same number of men as with women.
There were singers in your family, right?
Mm-hmm. My mother was a singer. She was the original Muriel Cigar on the radio. And she sang things like Blue Bonnet Margarine commercials and Royal Pudding, I remember. I actually grew up in a control room. And my grandfather, her father, was a singer and had a music conservatory in New York. And her mother was a concert pianist. So I do come from a musical family.
So singing was no big deal in your family. It was just what people do.
Yeah, it seems pretty, it was pretty natural to me. I sang a lot as a child, and I started with piano music, piano lessons when I was young, and I read music at a very young age. I have a, you know, when I was a child, they didn't have tape at that time, but they had those little records that you could make at home. So I have one or two of those, and there's one of my grandfather, who was in his 80s, my mother, and me. I must have been maybe about 8 years old, singing Silent Night in harmony. So it's like three generations of singers singing Silent Night together, and it's really, really great to hear.
That sounds wonderful. Your music is so emotional, and there have been times in the world of the avant-garde and new music when people tended to have more of a posture of irony and distance than emotional directness. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time when it was difficult for you to be accepted because of the emotional depth of your music?
Yeah, I think the 60s was a pretty hard period on that level, because minimalism was a very strong impulse in all the arts, I mean, in painting and in music and theater. And I think they saw that way of dealing with emotion as romantic, but I actually don't feel that that's what it's coming from. I think it's a very direct, straightforward kind of way of dealing with human experience. I think that in the way that I work is that if I start with something, I try to let that tell me what to do with it. I mean, it's really like I work on material, and I try to see what that material wants in terms of a form. And that could go anywhere from depth of you know, I don't like to say tragedy, but, you know, sadness, to something like comedy.
When you're singing, do you just totally lose yourself in the music?
That's a hard thing to answer. What is going on in my mind during the time I'm singing, right? That's actually the question.
Yeah, and if you're feeling the emotion that you're conveying, or if you're really caught up in the technique of it as well.
Well, I think all of the above. I think that it's hard to describe it. It's not really that, strangely enough, it's not that I'm feeling the exact emotion that I'm conveying, because then in a way, if I was doing that, it wouldn't really leave any room for the audience. So it's sort of, I'm not really aware of myself thinking. That's one of the things that's wonderful about performing, is that you don't, your thought process, that kind of discursive mind, and during the best performances, the discursive mind is not working. You really are where you are. You are exactly where you are, and it has a kind of pinpointed consciousness. And also, in the best performances, it also has a feeling of openness. So there's the pinpoint and the openness simultaneously.
Meredith, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Composer and singer Meredith Monk. Her new album is called Do You Be. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, of course, we'll have a report on Robert Bork's decision to hang tough. He says he's not quitting. He says because there should be a full public debate about his qualifications to serve on the High Court. And next stop for the nomination, the Senate floor. Also tonight at the UN, the Iranians blasted the U.S., that was earlier today, for attacking and disabling three of its boats. Iran vowed that in due time, these are the Iranians' words, Iran will retaliate. And a story on how doctors feel about treating patients with AIDS. Quite frankly, many of them are scared.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of some of the latest releases on home video, including a mid-50s thriller, The Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters. Ken says Mitchum's character in this movie has continued to influence popular culture.
Talk about timeliness. On the new Bruce Springsteen album, Tunnel of Love, there's a song about a man who tattoos the word love on his right hand and the word fear on his left. Any movie buff listening to that song, Cautious Man, will probably feel a chill down the spine, because it's obvious that Springsteen has seen the 1955 thriller The Night of the Hunter, just released on video cassette. In The Night of the Hunter, Robert Mitchum plays a psycho killer preacher who tattoos the words love and hate on the knuckles of his hands. This is one of the most frightening, disturbing movies ever made. Set in the backwoods of West Virginia, The Night of the Hunter has a low-down, creepy plot. Preacher Robert Mitchum marries widow Shelley Winters in order to find out where her dead husband buried some money. Winters' two little wide-eyed children discover Mitchum's motives, and the man of God tries to scare them by showing them his switchblade.
Can I have my supper, please?
Naturally.
Can I have milk, too?
Mm-hmm. But first we'll have a little talk about our secrets.
No.
And why not, pray tell?
Because John said I must.
Never mind what John said. John's a meddler. Now stop that sniveling. Looky here. You know what that is? You want to see something cute? Now looky. How about that? This is what I use on meddlers. John might be a meddler. Now just tell me, where's the money hid?
But I swore I promised John I wouldn't tell.
John doesn't matter! Can I get that through your head, you poor, silly, disgusting little wretch?
The Night of the Hunter was the only movie directed by actor Charles Laughton. It's based on a novel by Davis Grubb and adapted with poetic grace by the novelist and movie critic James Agee. It's full of unusual things, including understated performances by both Shelley Winters and Lillian Gish. But when Robert Mitchum holds out his hands and flexes his love and hate knuckles, you'll know why the image stuck in the mind of Bruce Springsteen. It'll stick in yours, too, probably forever. Other new video cassette releases include The Red Shoes, director Michael Powell's version of the ultimate ballet movie, and Raising Arizona, Joel and Ethan Coen's version of the ultimate screwball comedy, featuring one of the most serenely beautiful babies you'll ever see kidnapped. And lovers of Hepcat campiness will want to check out the video cassette debut of Robin and the Seven Hoods, the ultimate Rat Pack movie. It features Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., and Bing Crosby all singing a song called Mr. Booze. 20 years ago, that was cool. Now it just sounds weird.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with folk singer Hazel Dickens. She performs in Mate One, the new John Sayles movie about a bloody West Virginia coal miner strike. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review compact disc reissues of Sessions tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins, recorded in 1944. And David Bianculli will be here with his review of What's New in Television. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. The address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.